So our words for calling us to worship this morning are from the Reverend Gary Kowalski. We gather here to worship, to seek the truth, to grow in love, and to join in service, to celebrate life's beauty and find healing for its pain, to honor our kinship with each other and with the earth, to create a more compassionate world, beginning with ourselves, to wonder at the mystery that gave us birth, to find courage at journey's end, and to listen for the wisdom that guides us in the quietness of this moment. As Mike lights our chalice this morning, I share these words attributed to the Buddha. Be ye lamps unto yourselves, be your own confidence, hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp. The flaming chalice is the symbol of the Unitarian Universalist religion. Please join now in body, rise in body or in spirit for our opening hymn number 38, Morning Has Broken. Please join now in our covenant and affirmation. Love is the spirit of this church and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Michelle doesn't get to read my sermon before she picks her words for the Message for All Ages when she does it, and I don't get to read her words for Message for All Ages when I write my sermon, so I was amazed to see how perfectly they dovetailed together today, and I just want to give a shout out to, you know, an excellent director of religious education. Those words, Michelle.
So today, Sydney's going to be talking about spirituality and nature. Now, spirituality, to try and explain that, that's difficult to do. So I'm going to try my best, and then I'm going to give you some examples of where people might feel this feeling. So to me, spirituality is when you feel like you're part of something way bigger, like that you just are surrounded by something that makes you feel in awe. Not like an amusement park, like you can feel awed there, but like more like you're just part of the world and you're one piece appreciating all of the world. So I'm going to read some things to you, and I want you first, though, to close your eyes for just 1 minute and think about the place you love best in nature. And see that place and just take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. You can keep your eyes closed while I'm reading, or you can open them. I stood upon the seashore early in the morning of a summer day. The gray-green of the sky and the gray-green of the sea met in a thin line, the one like the other, but the sea was alive, its pulse beat upon the shore. I stood upon a mountain when the year was spring and dwarf forget-me-nots scented the air with spice. A great blue shell of sky curved above me. Hills of pine and fir swelled green below me, and in the valleys between I saw mirrors for the sun. I walked upon the desert in the brightness of an autumn afternoon. The face of the sand lay wrinkled below me. It had no place to hide from the sun. In the distance, mountains bluer than the sky curved around the circle of the world. I went into the woods on a cool fall day. The colors shone in hues of red, orange, and yellow. The tree branches joined hands together, creating tunnels of beauty. The sun shone through the branches, its light danced all around me. I stood upon a hilltop at the edge of town one night in winter when the moon was half. Below me, streetlights twinkled like stars. Above me, the great city of the sky was ablaze with candles. An owl talked about it to a pine tree. When I stand upon a mountain, or stroll along the seashore, or look into the face of the desert, or walk in the forest, or climb to a hilltop at night, I am filled with a wonder. I am filled with a sense of awe. I am still inside of me. I am one with the world that surrounds me. I'm going to ask you to repeat some words. This is a Navajo prayer that we're going to end this message with. As I walk, as I walk, the universe is walking with me. Beauty is on every side. As I walk, I walk with beauty. And I hope that filled you and took you to that place where you feel connected and spiritual with nature. And at this time, we're going to take the light of our lantern the light of our chalice by way of lantern to our religious education program. And Corinne Murray is going to light and carry the lantern today.
Blessed be and amen. Our next hymn is number 15, The Lone Wild Bird, and it's about being filled with the Spirit, whatever that means to you. And so I invite you to position yourself how you feel like you might be best filled with Spirit this morning, whether that's sitting or standing.
Thank you.
Our reading is by Henry David Thoreau, or I'm told to say it properly, you must say Thoreau. How many people are going to be annoyed, other than my husband, if I say Thoreau? Okay, there is one, so I'll try my best. This is from Walden. I did not read books the first summer. I hoed beans. Nay, I often did better than this. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. I love a broad margin into my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie, amidst the pines and the hickories and the sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun's falling in at my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded by the lapse of time, I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not my time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals mean by contemplation and the forsaking of works. For the most part, I reminded not how the hours went. The day advanced as if to light some work of mine. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable is accomplished. Instead of singing like the birds, I silently smiled at my incessant good fortune. As a sparrow had its trill sitting in the hickory before my door, so had I my chuckle or suppressed warble, which he might hear out of my nest. My days were not days of the weeks, bearing into the stamp of any heathen deity, nor were they minced into the hours and fretted by the ticking of a clock. For I lived like the Puri Indians, of whom it is said that for yesterday, today, and tomorrow, they have only one word, and they express the variety of meaning by pointing backward for yesterday, forward for tomorrow, and overhead for the passing day. This was sheer idleness to my fellow townsmen, no doubt, but if the birds and flowers had tried me by their standard, I should not have been found wanting. A man must find his occasions in himself, it is true. The natural day is very calm and will hardly reprove his indolence. I had this advantage, at least in my mode of life, over those who were obliged to look abroad for amusement, to society and the theater, that my life itself was to become my amusement and never ceased to be novel. It was a drama of many scenes and without an end. And if we were always indeed getting our living and regulating our lives according to the last and best mode we had learned, we should never be troubled with ennui. Follow your genius closely enough, and it will not fail to show you a fresh perspective every hour. Has some archaic language in that piece, but still worth hearing. And this is also from Walden. And in it, Henry David Thoreau writes of what the cost of building his house by Walden Pond was. He writes, "The exact cost of my house, paying the usual price for such materials as I used, but not counting the work, all of which was done by myself, was as follows, and I give the details because very few are able to tell exactly what their houses cost, and fewer still, if any, the separate cost of all the various materials which compose them. Boards, $8.35, mostly shanty boards. Refuse shingles for roof and sides, $4. Lathes, $1.25. Two second-hand windows with glass, $2.43. 1,000 old brick, $4. Two casks of lime, $2.40. That was high. Hair, 31 cents, more than I needed. Mantle tree iron, 15 cents. Nails, $3.90. Hinges and screws, 14 cents. Latch, 10 cents. Chalk, 1 cent. Transportation, $1.40. I carried a good part on my back. In all, $28.12. Thus ends the reading. Alas, our house is more expensive. prices have risen in the 160 years or so since Walden was published, and it is for the maintaining of our house, both physical and metaphorical today, that we appeal. And so now it is time for the gifts of the congregation. Good morning. When I was in high school, I spent a week at a continental conference, ConCon, which was for Unitarian Universalist youth. They had ConCons every year in those days. I don't know if they still do. One day, we were divided into our touch groups, as they called them, the groups that you touch base with every day and check in with. And we were told to go out and create an altar or a sacred spot somewhere out in nature. And after that, we would go on a tour of all the different groups' spots. So my group found a nice, flat spot of land where there's a dirt patch surrounded by really vibrant green grass. And we took some different colors of earth and some stones and twigs and feathers and the like, and we drew a chalice on the earth and put some special things around it. And we realized, I think after the tour of all the different spots, that the reason this part of the earth was so flat and the grass there was so green was because we had built our altar on the septic tank. This is an example of what I do not mean when I talk about transcendentalism and the spirituality of nature. Rather, I am talking about how our spirituality derives from nature, the feeling of awe, of wonder, the sense of the ultimate or God, or the vastness of space that you feel when you're out in the natural world. When you talk to Unitarian Universalists, you hear over and over from people, not all of us, but a good percentage of us, that where we feel most spiritual is in nature. How many of you is that true for? Yeah, 80 or 90% there. out in the woods or on top of a mountain or in the Great Prairie or by the seashore and all those examples that Michelle gave us such beautiful examples of. As Richard Higgins writes in an article on Thoreau and the nature and nature writing, he says, "Theology and dogma left Thoreau cold, but imbibing nature through the portals of his senses moved him to religious rapture. Such ecstatic experience was the heart of Thoreau's spirituality, but it was not all of it. Nature, he believed, was a mystery pointing beyond itself." So I think there are two ways to approach the transcendentalism of our sages of Concord, really. One is to dissect it, the sort of Emersonian way, to dissect it and study it thoroughly, if you'll forgive the pun. The other is to go to the woods. Emerson himself tells us this in his Divinity School address, where he tells the story that will frighten Unitarian ministers ever since. In the Divinity School address, he tells the story of going to a dismal church service, and snow is falling beautifully outside, but inside, the preacher is a stuffy example of someone with no connection to that beauty. Emerson writes, "A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him, and then out the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had no one word intimating that he had laughed or wept or was married or was in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. The man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books. He had eaten and drunken. His heart aches, his head aches, his heart throbs. He smiles and suffers. Yet there was not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all." We're all scared to live up to that ever since. This is words preachers take to heart. Unitarianism was an ill-fitting suit for Emerson and Thoreau in those days. Their transcendentalist philosophy of finding their religious experience in the natural world around them, of every person having direct access to the transcendent, that was not part of our faith and was in really conflict with the Unitarianism of its times. But as time moved on, we caught up with that and embraced it, and indeed, not only embraced their love of the natural world and their direct connection to the holy, we embedded it back into our faith. It's in our principles. It's in the sources we draw from. But if you look at Unitarian Universalist churches today, it's even embedded into the architecture of churches that were built after that time. If you look at UU churches, you see many ways that nature is reflected in church buildings. While it isn't simply practical in many climates, such as ours, to hold worship out in nature every week, there are churches that have. There was a church down in Florida that purchased their land and held all their worship services outside while they first built religious education space, making that a priority, and then later built their sanctuary building. There's a church in the Illinois suburbs where the architecture reflects nature in many ways, from the door handles being carved, being like wooden branches, to the pulpit, which is, like Emerson's tombstone, a big, unhewn rock, big boulder of a pulpit. And there's a skylight above the pulpit that lets the sun shine directly down on the preacher. It is a very hot place to preach, literally. Other churches are built out in the woods or built with huge glass windows in the sanctuary to let that nature pour in. We have some pretty big, huge glass windows here. There used to be debates in theological school about that architecture of having the big glass windows behind the preacher. many ministers-to-be were nervous about having to compete with nature and falling short, as Barzilai Frost does in Emerson's Divinity School address. But yet there's a reason we want to bring that outside in. We're in an older building that has very traditional church architecture, but yet we have embedded a love of nature all around us, from images that you see woven into tapestry on our wall of nature, strawberries and rainbows and sunshine and the earth itself, to the way we have created beautiful gardens around our space and preserved a sense of being out in nature in here. As you look out your windows, you see the autumn trees. As a faith, we worked to create principles that talk about the interdependent web, and we talk about earth-based religions being one of the religious sources from which we draw in the sources statement that follows our principles in the UUA bylaws. We became that faith which I think the transcendentalists would see the line from their faith to ours in, that clear connecting thread that spins from their faith to who we have become. One of the reasons I think that this theological view is so important to us is that it brings in a sense of awe, of wonder, of mystery that is rare and precious in our modern age. And in being in our modern age, when we drive on pavement all the time, and many of us go into rooms with, you know, office walls and that horrible asbestos tile, right, hanging over us, or and hardly spend any time out in the natural world, that time in the world, out in nature, becomes so much more precious to us. Being in touch with it gets us into a deeper part of our spirit that makes us feel part of the world and part of the cosmos. I'm sorry, did the emitter of asbestos tile go here? did I step on something? No? Okay, I'm good. The intricacy of something very small, the butterfly wing, the petals of a daisy, a pern frond, the little lines that weave through even the smallest pebble, and the vastness of great things, of large things, the number of grains of sand on the beach, the width and depth of the ocean, the height of the mountain. These are the things that help us to understand our place in the order of things, that we are both very, very small, and we are also infinitely precious. Mary Oliver writes about this, I think, in Wild Geese when she says, "Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of rain are mowing across the landscapes, over prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things." Thoreau says similarly, "The universe is wider than our views of it." And he talks about being the sense of being one with nature, and that nature helps him find a place in the cosmos when he says, in the ponds, "Then I live to Walden even, I am its stony shore, and the breeze that passes o'er, in the hollow of my hand are its water and its sand, and its deepest resort lies high in my thought." And then about those beans, he says, "Meanwhile, my beans, the length of whose rows added together was 7 miles already planted, were impatient to be hoed. For the earliest had grown considerably before the last were in the ground. Indeed, they were not easily to be put off." What was the meaning of this so steady and self-respecting, this small Herculean labor, I knew not. I came to love my rows, my beans, though so many more than I wanted. Isn't that always the case with beans? They attached me to the earth, and so I got strength like Antaeus. But why should I raise them? Only heaven knows. This was my curious labor all summer, to make this portion of the earth's surface, which had yielded only cinquefoil, blackberries, John's wort, and the like before, sweet wild fruits and pleasant flowers, produce instead this pulse. What shall I learn of beans, and beans of me? Another part of that connection between nature and the spirit can be found in solitude, or in the quiet, or the noise of the natural world. Part of being in nature is about the physical connection between our bodies and the physical world, and losing the sense of where they separate, and understanding how we become one. Thoreau writes about these in Solitude in Walden when he says, "This is a delicious evening, and the whole body is one sense and imbibes delight through every pore. I come and go with a strange liberty in nature, a part of herself. As I walk along the stony shore of the pond in my shirt sleeves, though it is cool as well as cloudy and windy, and I see nothing special to attract me, all the elements are unusually congenial to me. The bullfrog trumps to usher in the night, and the note of the poor whippoorwill is borne on the rippling wind from over the water. Sympathy with the fluttering alder and poplar leaves almost takes away my breath. Yet, like the lake, my serenity is rippled, but not ruffled. These small waves raised by the evening wind are as remote from storm as the surface, smooth reflecting surface. Though it is dark now, and the mind still blows and roars in the wood, the waves still dash, and some creatures lull with the rest with their notes. The repose is never complete. The wildest animals do not repose, but seek their prey now. The fox and the skunk and rabbit now roam the fields and woods without fear. They are nature's watchmen, links which connect the days of animated life." There are many times when I've felt this sense of awe and wonder, this connection to the universe or God's creation. I'm sure many of you have had those kinds of moments too. Here's a simple story from Lynn Thurman, a writer on Pathos, in an article titled, "Do You Look for the Beauty?" She writes, "Earlier this week, I was walking through the woods near my house with my husband and daughter. There isn't much left of the woods, really, because development after World War II cut down the trees and repurposed the farms. Where there was once nature, there is now housing. Still, there are little patches of undeveloped land to enjoy. Not much, but some. As we were walking back along the tree-flanked path that leads to the back of the pub in the cricket field, a lady coming the opposite way stopped my daughter to ask if the path led to a road. It did. She was dressed vibrantly. Her long silver-white hair flowed out from under her Icelandic-style hat. She wore welly boots, a bright pink jacket, a rainbow scarf, and jeans. "I'm walking around here to see if I can see what the artist Martin Snape saw," she said. "He lived in Victorian times. They were hard times, you know. I wanted to see if any of the beauty he captured in his paintings still existed today." "Oh, well, there are trees along this path and back through the spinney. I won't walk far. I wish I'd brought my dog along, but he's quite mad," she laughed. And then the laughter dropped and she asked, "Do you look for the beauty?" It was out of the blue, a question from a slightly bizarre stranger that penetrated my soul. "Yes, yes, I do," I replied, and she nodded in approval. "So do I, all of the time. Are you an artist?" "No, not really. I'm more of a wannabe artist." She began to fumble in her jacket pocket. "Yes, me too. I'm a wannabe artist, and that's why I take photos, to capture the beauty." And she held out her camera to show me. She laughed again and said goodbye and walked along the path leading up to the road, and I went the other way, but this lady never left my mind. It was a chance encounter with a stranger out on a chilly autumn to look for beauty. I do look for beauty, but sometimes I forget. I see the housing and the busy roads and the industrial estates and the shops and the destruction humans cause. I needed to meet this lady. I needed the reminder to look for the beautiful. Is this a message you needed to hear too? She concludes. Do you look for beauty amid the asbestos tile? Do you look for that way of finding that moment of pure delight. Another way of saying this is when Mary Oliver's poem, she talks about the grasshopper in the summer's day, and she says, I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thoreau has his answer. His famous words from Walden are exactly an answer to that question that nature makes Oliver pose. What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thoreau says, I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not when I came to die, to discover that I had not lived. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? Another poet carries a similar answer when Robert Frost says, I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one last traveled by, and that made all the difference. So, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? Will you choose the road less traveled by? Live deliberately. Look for beauty. May it be so. Our closing hymn is number 163, For the Earth Forever Turning. Please rise in body or in spirit. Our words of benediction, also from Henry David Thoreau. Do not be too moral. You may cheat yourself out of much life. Aim above morality. Be not simply good, be good for something. Go confidently in the direction of your dreams. Live the life you have imagined. And as you simplify your life, the laws of the universe will be simpler. May it be so.